From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you. You, our listeners. We're very thankful for every one of you and grateful for your support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Sunday is the Christian feast of St. Nicholas. Sundown Sunday brings the start of the Jewish celebration of Hanukkah, which continues until December 14th. Tuesday, Buddhists mark Rahatsu, Bodhi Day, which is also the Catholic feast of the Immaculate Conception. For Orthodox Christians, the Advent fast begins on the 12th. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
You know, the media promptly wants to blame him on the pro-life movement when it's also reported that he was registered as an independent and as a woman and a transgender leftist activist, if that's what he is.
The tragic shootings at a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs, Colorado, sparked both sadness and grief, and widespread arguments about what role recent attacks on the health nonprofit at the highest levels of our government may have played in inspiring the shooter, Robert Deere. This week, I want to focus on the most direct ways conflicts over Planned Parenthood and abortion in general touch most of us. The divide between friend and neighbor, sister and brother, over this most polarizing of issues. On the front lines of dealing with the aftermath of the shooting and of working for healing in the community is the Reverend Amanda Henderson. And Amanda will be here with us on this week's show.
Homosexuals are worthy of death. His words, not mine. And I am not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ.
It's rather astounding to think that the groundbreaking Supreme Court decision legalizing marriage equality for all was handed down just this past summer. Somehow it seems like it's been a lot longer than that already. But it's been a year of significant events for LGBT Americans, not all positive, but all impacting individual lives and communities. Peter Montgomery is a tireless chronicler of many of these events, both at home and around the world. And this week, I'll ask Peter what he thinks the most important events of 2015 so far have been in LGBT rights. But first,
they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists.
I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
Blood coming out of her, wherever.
Thousands and thousands of people were cheering.
Gotta see this guy. Oh, I don't know what I said. I don't remember.
It wasn't that long ago that for many of us, Donald Trump for president seemed kind of a funny thing to say. In recent weeks, things have definitely stopped being funny. With scattershot attacks on almost every minority group in America, with wild-eyed claims that seem to do nothing but frustrate the news media and excite his base, the new Teflon Don is dominating the Republican race for the White House and drowning out all the other candidates, Democratic or Republican. Although I much prefer to have a chuckle or two at the state of our politics with my friend Greg LaBelle, assistant professor of political management at George Washington University, I also find it comforting to be with Greg when things aren't so funny. And so I'm grateful to be able to welcome him back to State of Belief Radio today, hopefully to help sort out the unsortable. Greg, welcome back.
It's nice to be here, Welton.
I want you to trust me enough to play a game with me on the first question. try to remember the beginning of this whole presidential campaign.
Okay.
All right, we're right at the beginning. I say the words, Donald Trump. What do you think immediately?
ha, ha, ha. I think like most of America, we thought, you've got to be kidding me.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, today,
yeah,
in the campaign,
yep,
I say the words, Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
How is it different?
It couldn't be more different. The Republican Senatorial Committee released an internal document that found its way out, as they often do, that begins to set up their Senate campaigns for dealing with a Trump nomination. This has become possible. It still feels funny to say, but people are taking this suddenly very seriously, and both Republicans and Democrats are preparing for this possibility.
So when did you get serious about it?
Probably in the past week. And I think part of it is denial. I think we look at this situation and we look about what it says about where this country is, and it's a little bit disconcerting. We just keep waiting for those numbers to drop, and they don't drop. So there's something going on that we have to be serious about, that we have to look at. Even if Trump doesn't end up the nominee, what brought him this far is something that we have to seriously consider in this country, what the public attitude is that gets us here.
Greg, Trump has blatantly attacked Mexicans and other immigrants. He has attacked veterans. He has attacked African Americans and Muslims and the disabled. And none of it seems to hurt him. I have two questions for you, or maybe more accurately, I want to ask you the following question twice.
Okay.
You've spent a lifetime in campaign politics. So first, I want to know how you would analyze this phenomenon through conventional Beltway wisdom. And then second, is there a brand new set of rules? And if so, are you able to wrap your head around that set of rules?
Well, the first question can't be answered in the context of normal, regular, inside the Beltway rules. I think that those simply don't apply, certainly to this candidacy. There are a couple of factors that may be at play, three theories, I should say, about what's going on. One is that this is just very entertaining. People are entertained by this guy. Mm-hmm. The other is that people haven't really started to take this seriously yet. And the third is that there are people who absolutely think that Donald Trump should be president. I suspect that all three are at play. The closest we can get to a traditional approach to this is that here we are the week after Thanksgiving. We're heading headlong into Christmas and New Year's. This is a time when campaigns sort of shut down in the sense that voters kind of shut down. They're moving away from politics. They're focusing on the holidays. So in campaigns that I was, we always sort of dreaded getting to Thanksgiving because we kind of had done all we could do until we get over that hump into the first of the year. But what that means now is that the campaigns are really sort of settling in. The numbers are starting to settle in, and they really won't move much until we get around that corner. This is a little bit different this year because we've got about a month between New Year's and the Iowa caucuses. Mm-hmm. In 08 and 12, that wasn't the case. We had days between the holidays. So the campaigns will have a little bit more time. So we're seeing the folks who are actual, I think, potential challengers to Trump sort of trying to lay the groundwork for what's going to happen after we get through New Year's. I was up in New Hampshire in October. I took my students to New Hampshire as part of a course, and they were all working on campaigns. Some were with Clinton. Some were with Sanders. I had one with Trump. We had some with Fiorina and others. And it was interesting watching the Trump campaign close up. They're not doing it the way anybody else does it. And this is sort of Trump's trademark. And
what's different?
He's running almost solely on his name recognition. And other candidates have tried this and failed. But Trump is running on the fact that he's Trump, much like he's run every business that he's ever been involved in. You know, the big Trump name on the front of everything. That's almost what's going on here. Mm-hmm. They're not in New Hampshire doing the basic door-to-door stuff, which is such an essential part of traditional New Hampshire politics. Mm-hmm. They're just not doing it. They're doing big rallies, bringing him in and building crowds and getting people to sign up at these rallies. It's not the way anybody else is doing it up there, Republican or Democrat. And clearly, it seems to be working.
Well, for me, and I know for you too, there's a moral component to all of this. I'm just sick and tired of having this one guy constantly shouting terrible things about my fellow Americans every time I turn on the television.
Yeah.
Even separate from politics, this is just plain wrong.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's not limited to Donald Trump. We've seen some of the other Republican candidates pick up some of this language and some of these ideas and run with it, you know, to suggest that we should only let Christians, Syrians in the country, to raise the idea of Muslims carrying identity cards. I mean, then you get into the things we've heard about women and gays and lesbians and every minority group you can think of. It's appalling. It's disturbing. If it were just Donald Trump, I don't think I'd be as disturbed by it. But we see other candidates. I think it's a short-term strategy on some of their parts. They see that this is working, so they figure they've got to try to. I mean, John Kasich is a pretty reasonable guy. I mean, he's a member of Congress. He's a governor of a major state. I would never have, you know, identified him as a crazy. But he's come out with some of these sort of ideas. And I think it's strategic on their part. And it's appalling to me that these folks would let a short-term strategy have that sort of impact on themselves and on the country. We tend to focus on what this means for the nomination and ultimately for the general election. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to start thinking about what this says about our image in the world, because the rest of the world is watching this and hearing this. And I think they're trying to figure out who the hell we've become as
right.
a country.
Trump seems – his audacity seems – to have freed up everybody else to say anything that they think immediately, whether they have really thought it through or not. And then if the media challenges them, they blame the media for the bad rhetoric.
Ben Carson, over and over again.
Okay, so in all of your years, have you seen that strategy work before?
No, it's never worked before. And candidates have tried various components of this strategy, and eventually it catches up with them and it fails. Now, it still may. We're sort of locked in now. Things aren't going to change much for a few weeks. But once we get to the first of the year, then the question becomes, do the voters in Iowa and New Hampshire and then Nevada and South Carolina begin to really start looking? Is it that voters are just sort of entertained and not really taking this seriously right now? I don't know. I hope so. But I don't know. But there's no question that there's a strain in this country of people who actually believe this stuff. Ben Carson has gotten into trouble now for saying some things that for Carson have been relatively reasonable. His comments about the shooting in Colorado, where he said there's violent rhetoric on both sides. In general, one can sort of nod and say, yeah, that's probably true. And by saying that, he's honked off a lot of his supporters and the religious right, because he's suggested that maybe there's been some intemperate comments made that maybe lead to these kinds of tragedies. There are people who are buying into this.
Greg, have we, the electorate, have we always been vulnerable to this kind of campaigning? Are we revealing some real weaknesses in the democratic process?
Well, I think there's been a strain of this mentality in the electorate for many, many, many years, maybe as long as we've been around. I think what's different is that we have this guy in Donald Trump who seems to be able to articulate it in a way that works, that's believable. And his background, everything that we know about him, whether it's true or not, every part of the bio sort of reinforces his credibility as a spokesperson for this mentality. And I think that's why he's been successful at it.
Greg, things are simply too volatile, so I would never ask you to predict what's going to happen next.
But
but I would like for you to volunteer to try to predict what's going to happen next.
Well, here's what I will say. Ben Carson has, I think, done himself in. I think Ben Carson has proved that being a surgeon is not enough. His statements on a number of issues have been so patently ridiculous that his numbers are dropping. They're dropping in Iowa, which is where I think he really stood a chance of distinguishing himself, if not winning outright, challenging Donald Trump there. So I think Carson is on the way down. I think what we're going to see now is a grand battle between Rubio and Ted Cruz. Mm-hmm. It's starting. I mean, these two guys are going to fight it out. They see themselves as the people who can sort of either do well enough to keep sort of carping at a victorious Trump or actually win outright. I think one of the two of them could potentially win Iowa. If I were putting money on it, I'd put money on Cruz, partly because he's run a very smart race. He's got lots of money. And he's been very strategic in dealing with Trump. Mm-hmm. He has not criticized him very much. So Trump's supporters find him appealing and a nice alternative. So if people start to move away from Trump, I think that's where they go. He's already begun to pick up some of Ben Carson's support. Mm-hmm. So the guy I'm watching now is Ted Cruz, at least in Iowa. In New Hampshire, depending on what happens in Iowa, Trump can come out of Iowa in a close race with Cruz or somebody else and do well in New Hampshire. Cruz will not do well in New Hampshire. He just doesn't fit the profile. New Hampshire is not a strong religious right state. Mm-hmm. The interesting person to watch there, I think, and I can't believe I'm saying this, is Governor Christie. Mm-hmm. Who would have thought that Chris Christie would look relatively reasonable in this collection of candidates, but Trump has given him that. So I think Chris Christie has some potential, and the rest of them, I think, are just hanging on for dear life.
Greg LaBelle is assistant professor of political management at George Washington University, where he is the director of the Semester in Washington Politics program. A veteran of several presidential campaigns, Greg has also served, and we should mention this more often, as director of public policy, director of political and field operations, and interim executive director of Interfaith Alliance. Greg, it is always great to sit down with you. Thank you for once again being with us on State of Belief Radio. We've been through a bunch of these campaigns, and I'm glad we'll be going through another one together.
Thank you, Elton. We'll see how it all plays out.
Even if you don't know his name from the byline, chances are you've read some of the writing that my next guest does on a daily basis. Peter Montgomery is a senior fellow at People for the American Way, and along with his colleagues, Peter provides some of the best reportage on just how aggressively the religious right is trying to change the very nature of this country. Recently, when three presidential candidates attended an Iowa hate fest misleadingly titled Freedom 2015, the only video available, even to national journalists like Rachel Maddow, came courtesy of rightwingwatch.org, a project of PFAW, and one of the places you'll find Peter Montgomery's work. With the year drawing to a close, I wanted to invite Peter back on State of Belief to look back at some of the far right's biggest hits, so to speak, as well as the progress LGBT Americans have made in 2015. Peter Montgomery, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks. Always happy to be here.
Look, you spend a lot of your time writing about the dark side. Before we go there, how would you grade this year for LGBT rights overall?
Sure. I mean, we had some amazing progress with the Supreme Court decision granting marriage equality nationwide, which is really kind of an earth-shattering decision. And it leads right into the story of the backlash against that and the debates we're going to see in the election year around religious liberty and how that will play out in the next big goal for the mm-hmm. LGBT movement, which is getting everybody covered by non-discrimination laws. So yeah. I think there was some great progress there.
Give me the top three positives for you.
I would say the marriage equality decision. I would say the fact that there was some strong mobilization against some of the religious exemption laws that were tried to be pushed around the country. And I would say polling that shows that there's continued progress in public opinion, mm-hmm. both on marriage and non-discrimination, and the fact that even among white evangelicals, we get 60% support for workplace non-discrimination laws. And I think that's a real sign of the long-term impact that our advocacy has had.
Mm-hmm. Was Houston an exception that won't be repeated, or is that one that's going to have to be dealt with in a lot of other places?
It's going to have to be dealt with. It certainly was a piece of bad news we're going to see it fought out, I think, repeatedly. It's clear that the right knows that they have a hard battle against discrimination laws. You know, they can't really make a principled argument against that. So they've latched onto this promoting fear around bathrooms and hysteria as a way to do it. And the ads that they ran in Houston were so ugly and so unprincipled and inflammatory that I really found it shocking. I don't know why anything surprises me anymore about the religious right, but I still get surprised. And those ads surprised me. And because they worked for them, we're going to see that same campaign, you know, that LGBT equality and that non-discrimination laws are a threat to children. It's going to be fought out in Jacksonville, Florida. And so there's no question that as we push for non-discrimination laws around the country, we're going to see that tactic. And so advocates for equality really have to figure out a better way to take that on.
Yeah. Tell me how you see that increased backlash. What are the leading edges of it?
Well, I think one of the big leading edges is that we see pretty much unanimity among the Republican presidential candidates talking about LGBT equality as a religious liberty issue. This is something that the right wing has been trying to change the frame for a long time. The evangelical leaders and their allies in the Catholic hierarchy have really made a push to frame all of these equality issues as religious freedom issues. And that is now how the Republican presidential candidates are talking about it. So they've really adopted that. But we also have seen more extreme backlash. We've seen calls for nullification, for states to simply ignore the Supreme Court. And we have, you know, presidential candidates and state Supreme Court justices among the people making that argument, that the ruling is itself illegitimate and should be treated that way. And that's a little more troubling. And we have Ryan Anderson from the Heritage Foundation, who's one of the, you know, fresh young faces of the anti-gay right, has sort of put out a book laying out a long-term campaign to resist this, building on the model of how the right resisted Roe v. Wade. And for 40 years, they've been fighting and chipping away and undermining women's access in spite of that decision. And he's laid out a roadmap to make a generational campaign against marriage equality. So this is not going away.
People keep saying, well, what's so different? You say they're changing the definition of religious liberty. How are they changing the definition of religious liberty?
Well, we can go back to the Supreme Court ruling in Hobby Lobby, which, as people probably remember, was a large corporation owned by a religious family that wanted to oppose the Obama administration's requirement for contraception coverage. And the Supreme Court's conservatives in that case really gutted the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in two important ways. One, instead of requiring an inquiry into whether a law was substantially burdening a person's actual exercise of religion, they completely watered that down to anything that offended someone's religious beliefs. And that's a huge difference. It really tips the scales on the balancing act between religious liberty and other important interests. And then they sort of ignored the harm test, dismissed in this case that there was no actual harm, and we've seen that that's not true. And so going forward, one of the arenas that we may have to be able to push back on is to really look at those third-party harms and convince the court that that's going to be a real issue.
Yeah. Peter, you write a lot about far-right extremists who hijack the language of religion to advance agendas of bigotry. Who are some of your worst of the worst from this past year?
Well, I would say there's a radio show host, a guy named Kevin Swanson, who has repeatedly called, you know, says that gays should be executed. And what was so troubling about him was not so much that he's this extremist voice out there, but that he had three Republican presidential candidates come to a conference that he put on and happily share a stage with him, even though People for the American Way, a week before, called on all of them not to go, put out the record. So there's really no plausible deniability for Ted Cruz, Bobby Jindal, and Mike Huckabee, who went and shared a stage with someone who's repeatedly called for the execution of gay people. So I would put him near the top of the list. There's another guy who does a lot of online videos named Theodore Shubat, who also says that not only should gay people be executed, but that gay-affirming Christians are worthy of death. And he appeared in a documentary that was released this year by Janet Porter, who's a religious right activist, anti-choice and anti-gay activist. Her documentary included, you know, Rand Paul and Mike Huckabee and a couple of members of Congress. So there's this disappearing line between what you might call mainstream anti-gay work and then this really extreme, frightening anti-gay work. I spent a week in Salt Lake City at the World Congress of Families, and the day before that actually started, the really anti-gay right had their own one-day sort of pre-conference. And Brian Kamringer from Massachusetts was one of those. And he said, you know, we ought to be insulting and denigrating people because the Bible says that people who tear down public morality, that those people must be destroyed. And that was his call. So extreme rhetoric is out there. And it's really troubling to me. There is so little effort made by people who want to be president of the United States to distance themselves from it.
Would the people that you've mentioned be the ones that you're most worried about?
It's hard to say. I mean, I'm most worried about, you know, someone like Ted Cruz becoming president. So, you know, I'm most worried about the impact that someone who shares a, you know, really corrupted view of what religious liberty is, who shares antipathy for LGBT equality, you know, becoming president and putting three or four people on the Supreme Court. So that's what I'm most worried about.
Sure. What's the one story that you followed this year that you kept thinking, I wish this story would get more press? I wish the press would be aware of this and tell the whole story. I think it would help us.
I think one of the things that we've been fascinated by is the amount of love shown by the American religious right for Vladimir Putin, even as he is, you know, positioning himself in opposition to American interests in so many ways, even as we have Republicans, you know, calling him out for the anti-democratic strongman that he is. We have American religious right continuing to gush over him because they're so enamored of his anti-gay policies. You know, Franklin Graham went over and gushed about how Russia is going to, you know, be the sort of standing strong for Christian civilization. And as he's just one in a long parade of people. So that's something that I think they should be held accountable for. Mm-hmm. And another is the close connection with the really serious anti-gay laws that we see in Africa. Mm-hmm. You know, the World Congress of Families this year honored someone who's been a vocal defender of the laws in Uganda and Nigeria that put people in jail for years and years and years for being gay or for even advocating for gay equality. And yet they tried to position themselves as not really anti-gay, as just pro-family. And the contradiction is really stark. So we have a lot of American religious right figures that are intimately connected and participants in the World Congress of Families. And so I hope that they'll be held accountable for the extremism and the actual brutality and violence that they support by supporting that kind of legislation overseas.
What do those of us who talk about religious freedom all the time need to do as we talk about its importance and fear that it's going to be misused?
I wish I had a magic answer for that one. I think talking about religious freedom, what it is and what it isn't, yeah, and the fact that we do cherish it, that we're not opponents of religious freedom, that we also see this as a core constitutional guarantee. Yeah. I mean, right now, people who cry religious freedom when they're talking about LGBT issues are the same people who say, we should not let Muslims have mosques in this country, or we should not let refugees in unless they're Christians. And that is so un-American. So I think pointing out those hypocrisies where we can and saying that the freedom to believe and practice your faith, we do defend. What we don't defend is using your faith to hurt other people. And that's a real clear distinction.
Peter Montgomery is senior fellow at People for the American Way. His writing on LGBT issues and the religious right is voluminous. His writings are voluminous. You're always good, and it's always good to have you on the show. You enlighten us and in some ways inspire us to do what we need to be doing on this issue. Thank you for being here again.
Thank you, Welton. I'm so glad you're still doing the show.
Thank you. sadly, the Planned Parenthood massacre of November 25th is not even the latest mass shooting in this country. We all grieve for the lives lost this week in San Bernardino, California, as well as the many other deaths that don't make the national headlines day after day. Our stubborn refusal to act in unison to try to end the endless bloodbath in this country is a topic for another time, many more times. But today I wanted to focus on the circumstances of the Colorado Springs shootings because they happened in the tinderbox of abortion rhetoric in this country. Joining me now is the Reverend Amanda Henderson, Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance of Colorado. Amanda, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Would you start by talking about the work that you've done since the shooting on the work of healing?
You know, when I first got the message and saw the alert come across my screen last Friday morning, my heart just sank, because this is something that we are all too familiar with and something that I know that the women's reproductive justice movement has been preparing for and fearing for a while. So I immediately knew that we were going to need to stand together and stand with them and bring positive messages of healing and support. So we right away reached out to our community, both our partners in Colorado Springs and our partners with Planned Parenthood and the women's reproductive justice movement in general, and asked how we could help, how we might be able to come together and hold them and hold one another in this time of grief. So our first place that we started was naming our common heartbreak. And no one wants to be in these situations again and again, and we are all heartbroken. And when we start in that place, I believe that that opens us up to a space of healing.
Mm-hmm. I've read reports of some tension that has made its way even into that setting where healing is so needed. Can you talk a little bit about the tension that you feel there?
Yeah, I think that part of that tension arises when there is this inclination to be speaking positive messages for hope. At the same time, we have got to speak out and name when words are being used as acts of violence and words are being used to fan the flames of fear. And so in that tension of even speaking out against hateful rhetoric becomes itself a divisive act. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that tension is being able to both hold ground in naming what's right and naming that we must work for opportunity and equality and life for all people. And we need to speak out when something is obstructing that. At the same time, being able to do that in a way that doesn't further divide and further marginalize and further fan the flames of fear and division. It's a real dilemma for leaders in our time.
You know, that's exactly the core of what I wanted us to talk about today. When everybody seems to be locked in to their ideological silos, there's no hope for functioning together as one community anymore. How do you approach even beginning to bridge that divide?
I think that's a great question. I think that's the question of our time. And part of that has been fueled by this flippant use of words and this over-the-top rhetoric that each side has begun to participate in. So the first thing that we have to do is to step back from that. And that's hard to do. I think that that's a spiritual act of stepping back from the desire to lash back. And so being able to do that and to look for opportunities for genuine relationship and genuine dialogue. And too often we have these disconnected ways of throwing insults or lashing out without any sense of genuine relationship. And so we need more spaces and more opportunities to come together and have real conversations from a place of humility and strength. And that place of humility and stepping into that, that's not a compromise of our deepest values. Mm-hmm. And I think that we see that from the tops of our political leaders and rhetoric down to blog posts and comment sections. And it's heartbreaking that those two have become so similar. But I think that we need leaders who are willing to step back from the hateful rhetoric and to enter into genuine, authentic relationship.
How much harm is it doing, Amanda, to the very fabric of America to have something as personal as reproductive rights endlessly politicized the way we've seen it lately?
I think that it is extremely damaging. So many women feel under attack continuously for their own bodies. And, you know, for a country that names this value of freedom and rights and equality, for half of our population to be consistently treated as though their body, their most personal piece of themselves, is the subject of this political fire, it's very disheartening. And I think that it is such a distraction to our ultimate goals of creating just and equal societies that we have spent so much time fighting about and spending so much money on both defending and the people who are attacking rights, when these resources could actually be spent to care for people holistically and to really address care for women through assuring that all people have a living wage and access to child care and health care, and that we would be so much better served as a country by actually addressing holistically what it means to care for all people rather than attacking and controlling women's bodies.
Every one of those issues you mentioned, which should be for the common good, is controversial, and it's at the center of political debate. And it just – it makes you wonder if there's ever going to be a way that we can sit down and talk about the common good. To make that even worse, so often those controversial conversations end up using the language of religion. Have you found ways – to at least try to overcome that?
Mm-hmm. I think that you bring up a really good point. And what we need right now is imagination. And we need to be able to come together and imagine what the common good looks like. And there is this vital disconnect over what the common good looks like. And it seems like if we could bridge these ideological divides by sitting together and naming what do we hope for as a society, what does it look like to actually live into the dream of the founding of our country? What does it look like, which we fell short from the beginning, we've never been there. What does it look like to walk into and to move toward greater equality and freedom and rights? How might all people experience that vision, starting from that place of looking forward and imagining, rather than, you know, we constantly get stuck in these retractable ideological arguments that take us nowhere. And, mm-hmm. and we know that. We do it again and again. So what might it look like to have leaders? And I really see that this is a pastoral role and a faith leadership, a prophetic vision across traditions that can really name what does it look like and invite people to reflect on that. Because you're right, when I, you know, when I name those issues that need to be addressed for women's care, it does move into these fragmented ideological divides. And so how might we imagine a future more holistically that actually serves the common good?
I want to ask you, if you will, just to, for a moment, draw from your obvious sensitivities and tell us what it's been like living in Colorado this past week.
It's been exhausting. And I think that people are worn down and they're tired of the fights and really hoping for actual change. And it feels like we're having the same arguments and debates again and again. And so I think that in Colorado right now, a lot of people are grasping and trying to figure out a way forward. And so many are also turning to one another. Mm-hmm. So in that exhaustion, we realize that we can't do it alone. So many groups and organizations are working to come together in this time. Not that anyone has the answers, but in a sense of grief that we can't keep doing this and we need each other. Mm-hmm. So this afternoon, actually, we have a gathering at the Colorado Muslim Society, our largest mosque here in Denver, and people across different divisions are coming together. And we'd actually planned this after the attacks in Paris and Beirut around the world, and then have since had other multiple tragedies. But our coming together, we've named very clearly that our intent is to grieve together and to stand in solidarity in hope that we can move toward a more holistic and life-giving future together. So in Colorado, there's this real dualness. There's the sadness and exhaustion and determination that there is another way.
You are a family member. You're a mother. You run an organization that's interested in religious freedom being protected and in policies that are for the betterment of our nation. You are a minister with all of those sensitivities. What's happening to Amanda Henderson right now?
I'm relying on friends and support systems and having good, deep conversations. I'm both being softened and strengthened. And I think that, especially as people who really care about the world and the future, we can have a sense that we can make a difference. And we have this sense of urgency. I particularly just have this deep sense of urgency to create change and to work for a better community. And there's this deep realization that this is long-term work and nothing worth doing can be done in one long lifetime. So these moments are a constant reminder that this work requires patience and endurance and strength. At the same time, I know that without my own personal foundation of my family, my husband and my children and neighbors and community, that I wouldn't have the strength to keep speaking and working and listening. So I am relying on those people and making sure that those relationships are staying strong and connected in the midst of this work.
Amanda, that's so helpful. I want to say to you, and I want to say to our listeners, I do this fairly regularly, I guess, but the vision of this radio show from the very beginning was to air conversations that are civil, that take seriously the issues that we're dealing with and recognize that there are different perspectives on it, but that we can talk about those issues in a way that is helpful and in a way in which we address both the heart and the mind, both law and compassion. And you've helped do that. Amanda Henderson is Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance of Colorado, an ordained minister. She's doing great work at a time when bringing people together across any kind of divide is an act of both spiritual necessity and of patriotism. Amanda, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's been a gift. Thank you so much.
Before we go, let me tell you, all of us lost a good friend when David Cohen, a former president of John Gardner's remarkable institution called Common Cause, died this week. I say all of us because David was a lobbyist for the people of the United States, the people of the United States. When it came to opening the windows of our government and demanding transparency in all government agencies so all could see inside, I had the pleasure of welcoming David Cohen as a member of the board of Interfaith Alliance. I always thought David was one of the most astute people I knew when it came to strategy and public policy. My characterization of David is an oxymoron. He was a practical idealist. He knew his values and would not compromise them. But he also was pragmatic in developing plans for seeing those values endorsed. David Cohen was a quiet, smart, wise, and passionate man whom some of us knew as a major influence in designing a strategy for defeating the nomination of Robert Bork as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. David Cohen will be missed by all who care about democracy, freedom, and religious liberty. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We rely on listener support to keep this show on the air. As the end of the year gets closer, please consider a tax-deductible contribution to State of Belief and to Interfaith Alliance. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think really would be helpful to friends or acquaintances, please share it with them. It's very easy to do on Facebook, on Twitter, and at stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you'll find extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. They need you. You need them. We all need each other. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was.